from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning in our opening hour, freshman East Bay Congressman Eric Swalwell joins us in the studio. We'll get his take on the NSA surveillance controversy and pending immigration reform legislation, among other issues, including his defeat of 20-term Congressman Pete Stark. And we take your questions for the congressman. Post them now on our website, kqed.org/forum. Next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Former Dublin City Councilman and Alameda County District Attorney, Deputy District Attorney Eric Swalwell is with us this hour. He, at the age of 32, is the nation's second youngest congressman and California's youngest. He represents the 15th District, which includes Livermore, Hayward, and Union City. And we're glad to have him with us this morning. Congressman Swalwell, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate you bringing me on the show.
Glad to have you here. It's been a number of congressional representatives, as Congressman pointed out to me. We had Jared Huffman on recently and not too long ago, Jackie Speer. I'll get right to a big news story with you, though. Do you have a position on whether or not Edward Snowden should be extradited? In fact, before I hear your response to that, let's hear some cuts. What we're going to hear is actually Arizona Senator John McCain, who defended the NSA surveillance program on State of the Union with Candy Crowley, whereas on the other hand, Colorado Senator Mark Udall criticized it on This Week with George Stephanopoulos. First, let's hear Mark Udall and then John McCain.
My main concern is Americans don't know the extent to which they're being surveilled, George. We hear this term metadata, which has to do with when you make calls, where you make calls to, who you're talking to. I think that's private information. I think if the government's gathering that, the American people ought to know it. We ought to have a discussion about it. And frankly, I think we ought to reopen the Patriot Act and put some limits on the amount of data that the National Security Administration is collecting.
I do believe that if this was September 12, 2001, we might not be having the argument that we are having today. And perhaps there has been some overreach, but to somehow think that because we are having phone calls recorded as far as their length and who they were talking to, I don't think that that is necessarily wrong if they want to go further and they have to go to this court.
All right, there you heard two opinions, a leading Democrat and a leading Republican, and Senator Mark Udall and Senator John McCain alternately criticizing and defending the NSA surveillance program. I should mention that Congressman Swalwell comes from a family of Republicans, but he is a Democrat. He's also a 49er fan, even though everybody in his family roots for the Raiders. But I want to have you go on record because Edward Snowden, the former CIA employee who identified himself as a source of leaked information about this vast National Security Agency surveillance program, just put it to you baldly, should he be extradited?
I think the jury's still out, and we're learning more and more about this classified program called PRISM, which stands for a planning tool for resource integration, synchronization, and management of information. But, you know, we certainly should vigorously prosecute individuals who leak national security information. And I think there's questions that remain about whether what he is doing is whistleblowing or whether this is a legal approved program under the FISA court and he's leaking national security information. I think the real conversation, though, is about privacy and the FISA court and whether the FISA court and the Patriot Act is keeping up with technology. And I think we actually are now, this is what I think is a digital awakening. We, for the last 15 years, have become more and more technologically advanced. We put so much of our information from banking to social media to our public utilities. It's all online now. It's all on our phones. It's at our fingertips. And now we're starting to, you know, raise real questions. I think important questions about what role does the government have and what should they be able to do and invade our privacy, or what's that balance between national security and privacy? I tend to always bend towards privacy and the Fourth Amendment. As a prosecutor who, in every investigation and conviction I sought, I had to work within the Constitution, I think transparency and having independent review should always be the paramount importance in matters like this.
Well, you recently went on a tech tour through Silicon Valley, and Apple, Yahoo, Google, Microsoft, Facebook, Dropbox, they all essentially allowed their servers to be tapped into.
And that's what we're learning right now, is to what degree did these companies allow the government to access private information. Now, from what I know, and again, this is from press reports because the program is still classified, but from what I've gleaned so far is that these are investigations that the National Security Agency is making against foreign nationals. And there are more users on Facebook and who use Google who are foreign nationals than are Americans. And so what the NSA or what Director Clapper is saying is that if a foreign national uses Facebook, the FISA court and the Patriot Act allows the NSA to intercept those communications, but only with independent court review. So what I think we need to do is we need to go back and look at this court and whether the court is abusing its authority in allowing the NSA to receive this information from these technology companies.
It would seem, though, and I'm curious to have you on record on this, that with PRISM and with the whole scandal with the IRS and particularly with Verizon, added to the picture, that we're getting a sense here of an administration that has been, in violation of privacy. I mean, even people within the administration are saying that.
Well, again, privacy has to be our number one concern. We cannot sacrifice our personal liberties and privacy for security. And so I certainly think that conversation needs to be had. And, with the IRS, I think that's a separate issue. And I would take the IRS scandal out of that. I think the IRS scandal is a few rogue actors who should be disciplined, and the IRS should go back to the business of collecting revenue fairly for the American people. I think that there are
rogue actors, meaning underlings, not people in the upper tiers.
I don't think there's any evidence that President Obama or senior administration officials were targeting any of these Tea Party organizations. I think these are rogue actors, and until evidence is proven to the contrary, I think they should be disciplined. It's not how the IRS should conduct themselves. I think it takes away from important role that the IRS has, which is making sure that individuals are fairly paying their taxes. I've been an advocate of the IRS having more enforcement tools to go after people who are sheltering their taxes who are not paying. And these actors undercut, I think, arguments that are being made that they should be more vigorous in going after wealthier individuals who are using offshore accounts or are not paying their fair share. So that's certainly devastating to arguments like those, which I think have merit. But when you talk about privacy, I think the issue with Verizon and the issue with PRISM, we should certainly have a conversation about that. The Patriot Act is going to sunset in 2015, and perhaps we should visit the Patriot Act sooner and look at, just exactly whether our laws are keeping up with the type of data that Americans have now on their phones and their computers.
Talking, if you've just joined us, with Congressman Eric Swalwell, represents the 15th District in California and parts of the East Bay, including Hayward and the Tri-Valley area, Dublin, Livermore, Pleasanton. Let me go back with you for a moment to your campaign. It was kind of a Quixote campaign in many ways. You saw an opportunity and, to your credit, took it despite the fact that you were being pressured by higher-ups. This has been made public. Not only pressured, but kind of given the cold shoulder for running against Pete Stark, who was in Congress for 40 years and continued to make more gaffes throughout the campaign, including charging you with taking bribes and all sorts of things that probably hurt his campaign a great deal, refusing to debate. Nevertheless, the fact is, I'm just curious how much of those fences have been mended with higher-ups in the Democratic Party who really were trying to get you not to run.
Well, I didn't run for Congress to run against the party. I saw an individual, Congressman Pete Stark, who had served for 40 years, I think with great distinction, but I believe that when you put the new district together that this Independent Redistricting Commission created and an open primary system, I didn't see him as fitting the area where I grew up. And 60% of the district was new for Congressman Stark. And he had gotten into what I thought was a bad habit of not coming home anymore and missing too many votes in Washington. And so I wanted to offer new energy and ideas. And you're right. When we first started, when I first announced just to maybe two dozen people who stood and listened to my announcement, the journey seemed like it was going to be nearly impossible, or at least improbable. And, you know, with the support of a lot of friends, family, and people who knocked on over 100,000 doors with me, I think, you know, we eventually made it inevitable. But since getting to Washington, I've worked and reached out to my colleagues in the Democratic Party. I'm honored that Leader Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi, has endorsed my reelection. I'm honored that the leadership on the Democratic side has named me as an assistant whip in the Congress. And I also received a ranking membership, which means I'm the lead subcommittee ranking member of the Energy Subcommittee on the Science Committee. So they have shown that I can work with them. And I think I've shown that I'm ready to work and, you know, advance the principles of the House Democratic leadership, which is growing and expanding our middle class and making sure that there's equal ladders of opportunity for everyone who wants to play fairly by the rules in our country.
Well, since you mentioned Leader Pelosi's backing of you for reelection, there's the old saying, you're not elected until you're reelected. And
there's another one. No one knows your name in Washington until you're reelected. I've heard that one, too.
Well, and you know, raising money can be a full-time job for congressmen to get reelected. It interferes with being a public servant. It's plain and simple, isn't it?
It's the worst. It's the worst part of this job is having to raise money. I think it's awful. I have supported the repeal of Citizens United to solve one part of campaign finance measures that need to be solved to take the corporate influence out of money. But right now, there's this fear that I and I know my colleagues in Congress live with right now, which is that an outside group can come into your race with 2, 3, 4 weeks left before Election Day and just carpet bomb your race with $1 million worth of television ads and completely turn the race upside down with negative or false advertisements. We saw in the last election $6 billion, $6 billion with a B, dollars were spent in the last 2012 election. So that makes us, I think, vulnerable to attack. It makes you a little paranoid. And so you have to be ready. And, you know, I don't enjoy that part of the job. I'd rather spend my time learning as much as I can about the issues, being out in the community, talking to my constituents. But I'm mindful that, you know, it is a part that I have to do. And
is it less pleasant than having to face all the polarization and all of the enmity that exists between the two parties now?
Well, on that end, you know, I have done my part with my classmates to try and fix that. And, you know, I'll just go back and say, you know, that's why I support repealing Citizens United. I've signed on to a number of other bills that one of them would create a public financing system, which I think also would take out the role of money in politics. As far as the polarization, they sent us to congressional orientation for 4 weeks, 2 weeks in Washington and 1 week in Williamsburg. And then the final week was at Harvard University. And that was my favorite part. My parents were more excited that I had gotten into Harvard than actually being elected to Congress. But at that lecture at Harvard,
Peter, you didn't matriculate, though.
No, and I didn't get a diploma when I left. But Peter Orszag presented to us, and Peter laid out just how gridlocked the Congress was and how few bills had been passed over the past few Congresses and just how hyperpartisan it had become. And he challenged us and he said, if this Congress behaves like prior Congresses, that we're going to fall farther and farther behind, debt and deficit will grow and the American people will suffer. So the 85 freshmen that were there, a small group of us got together and started talking about what issues we could find, small or big, to work together. And we grew that group from that evening in the hotel lobby from about 5 to 6 to what is now called the United Solutions Caucus today, which is 30 freshman members, evenly
bipartisan.
Divided. Bipartisan. Evenly
drinking
divided.
Together, eating together, actually talking together?
Getting together, talking. We meet once a week. We rotate which office hosts it. Sometimes it's Republicans, sometimes it's Democrats. We produced a bill that has $200 billion in spending cuts, but also new revenue streams, which is important to me. I think if you're going to have cuts in spending, you need the balance of revenue coming in. And so, you know, it's one small step. I'm not naive. I know overnight you're not going to change the Congress, but I think it does take a snowball to create an avalanche. And just talking to each other and having mutual respect for each other is one effort in that, what seems to be insurmountable task.
Well, for a new congressman, you have some bona fides, and I wanted to get them on record here. You've been opposed almost from the beginning to the Transportation Security Administration trying to make it okay to bring knives on planes, and so that was a victory of sorts that you were involved in, that your parents can also take pride in. And also the amendment protecting the mass transit system, like BART, from terrorist attacks passed the House, $97.5 million, which had your name on it, or at least certainly your voice behind it. But let me ask you, as long as we're talking about, I want to talk more about security and all kinds of issues with you, but since money will go to BART now for security as a result of that amendment, what do you think about reports that former BART General Manager Dorothy Duggar earned more than $333,000 last year despite doing no work at all for BART in 2012?
I did hear that on KQED driving in this morning. And, I was troubled by it. I understand it was a legal contract that was executed. I don't think that BART did anything wrong in executing that contract. But I think it does start the conversation that we've actually been having about compensation for public servants. And, a lot of Americans are hurting right now, especially in our middle class. And when they see that public agency officials are making, mid six-figure salaries, that should give them pause. And I do hope that, public agencies, as we go forward, are mindful of, how much people are struggling out there. And if you're going to be asking BART passengers to take rate hikes to ride BART or pay more out to park, you can't pay the general manager, mid six-figure salaries and then, not...
Now, who's accountable in this, Congressman? Under a lucrative retirement scheme, she quietly just stayed on the books, burned off nearly 80 weeks of unused vacation time, drew paychecks and full benefits for more than 19 months after she agreed to quit back in May of 2011.
I think we're all accountable. BART has, an elected board and also, it's elected by the people. And, I would say there are journalists out there who have done a very good job of shining the light on public salaries. Dan Bornstein, he should probably win a Pulitzer Prize now for all the work he's done on, public salaries and transparency in government. So is Hatfield over there at Bay Area News Group. And so, I think we're all responsible, and we need to, re-examine just what we're paying, public figures. It's certainly, I think, making $300,000 to $400,000 to run a public agency is probably too high. You want to have a salary that's competitive, that attracts talent, but you should also – you don't want to be tone deaf, and you don't want to not have a read on what middle class or upper middle class Americans are making to do similar jobs or jobs that require just as much work. So it's a local story. I trust that the BART directors, and I know a number of them, they'll be able to read the tea leaves and hear from the people that this can't continue.
I mentioned the tech tour that you were on, and I want to get to another local story, which is bigger than local story, and that is immigration reform. It looks like, unlike what was attempt to struggle through some very watered down gun control or gun reform legislation being defeated, that there will probably be a bill. I get your take on this, but some kind of immigration bill. But I'm just wondering because, again, Silicon Valley, people like Zuckerberg and so forth seem to be so much in favor of immigration reform, which will mean something that will accrue to their advantage. They'll be able to hire, use the visas and so forth and take people for less money. And we've also got, a lot of tax loopholes in that world. They're doing things legally, but, when Tim Cook went in front of Congress and testified and said, we've paid every cent that's deserving, many American public feel maybe paying every cent that at least under the law he's supposed to be paying. But no, this is crazy kind of law. They're getting away with millions and millions offshore.
On immigration, just like you, I'm hopeful that we can have a bill. But I have to say, last week, I kind of felt like I've been telling my constituents, I have a very diverse district in, Hayward and Fremont, and you have a combination of high-skilled workers who want to, you know, have access to H-1B visas. We also have a large undocumented population who want to have that pathway to citizenship, which I support. And I've been telling everybody that, you know, everything I can glean from the Republicans are that is that they are serious about this. But last week when we were doing appropriations for a Homeland Security bill, there was an amendment that was put in right before the bill was passed that would increase funding to deport Dreamers. Now, these are children of undocumented immigrants who right now could be subject, without the president's executive order, could be subject to deportation, not have access to our schools. And these are the same kids who say the Pledge of Allegiance with their non-immigrant U.S. citizen classmates.
But forgive me, we should add, even though the president has spoken very poignantly, as he's wont to do, about the Dreamers and so forth, there have been protests and anger over the level of deportations in the Obama administration.
And so last week, and you're right, and I'll get to the deportations in a moment, but last week on the House floor, for what was supposed to be a bipartisan Homeland Security appropriations bill, which I had planned to support, turned into a partisan bill that called for the deportation and funding for deporting these Dreamers. And that passed. The Republicans were able to pass it on a party line vote. And it felt like a punch in the gut because I'd been going around telling everyone, we're going to be able to get a bill on immigration. Republicans are at the table. They want to negotiate.
And well, politically, it's to their advantage, isn't it? I mean, we see Marco Rubio crosses over right. from being, you know, against immigration reform to saying, I am for immigration reform, almost a kind of classic example of how they recognize that they need the Hispanic vote.
That's right. But in the House, it may be a different story. And so now, you know, I'm a little more reluctant to promise or at least note the cooperation of Republicans, because what happened last week was shameful. For the Republicans to want to deport, you know, these children of immigrants who came here by no fault of their own, I think shows that they're not as serious as they've been saying when it comes to comprehensive immigration reform. Now, I do support increasing the H-1B visas so that we can fill the shortage of high-skilled workers in our country, which is clear to me. It's evident in this valley that our children are not equipped with all the skills they need to compete for these jobs in technology, advanced manufacturing, health information.
But you know biotech. The argument, Congressman. They're taking jobs away from people who are here, who are native born.
And the argument that I would put forward is that those jobs will go overseas because the companies, to get an H-1B visa, they have to prove that they cannot fill the job. And they've been able to prove that. And we only have 65,000 H-1B visas in our country a year. And those 65,000 applications are filled within the first 5 days every year that they're offered. So in the short term, I think comprehensive immigration reform will allow us to fill jobs here in the United States. And we know that behind those immigrant jobs, we create more jobs. 40% of the largest companies in the U.S. were founded by immigrants or the children of immigrants. I also support that roadmap to citizenship for the undocumented, so not just H-1B visas, but undocumented individuals.
We're talking again with Congressman Eric Swalwell, who represents the 15th District of California. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call. Our toll-free number is available to you, 866-733-6786. Again, the number for your calls, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Go to our Twitter handle, which is @KQED Forum, and tweet us if you like, or go to our Facebook page. Many ways to communicate with us. Let's hear from you. Talking again with Eric Swalwell and with you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is freshman Congressman Eric Swalwell, who represents California's 15th District and is a Democratic representative to the U.S. House of Representatives here with us in studio. We're going to go to your calls in just a moment. I want to go to a couple of emails first, which actually asked to have you, if you would, Congressman, distinguish yourself from your predecessor. Let me just read these in tandem. Charles writes, Pete Stark bravely sponsored a bill to provide equal access and opportunities to be adopted by qualified parents, regardless of factors like gender, sexual orientation, by requiring states receiving federal funds to stop discrimination against these otherwise qualified families. What is Congressman Swalwell's position on this bill? And another listener writes, Pete Stark long supported Medicare for all. What is Representative Swalwell's position on nonprofit universal public health insurance?
You know, on the issue of our brothers and sisters in the LGBT community, I've sponsored a number of bills to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act, to increase federal benefits to LGBT individuals. And I also, you know, I have signed on to a bill that Congressman Stark originally sponsored, which would allow parents, LGBT individuals.
That was a direct question, yeah.
Yeah, to adopt, you know, foster children. So, no, I certainly support that. And when it comes to equality, you know, I do believe in equality for all, fair pay for women. You know, the Fair Pay Act was signed 50 years ago today by President Kennedy, but women still make about 74 cents on the dollar of what men make. And so, you know, fighting for equality is something I believe in. I was the hate crimes prosecutor for the Alameda County District Attorney's Office when I was there. And, you know, being someone that came from the middle class, a mother who still works as a secretary today, and my dad is a retired police officer, the priorities for me would be using the innovation agenda, technology, to grow and expand our middle class.
You put a lot of emphasis on innovation as a way really to expand the middle class, and it makes perfect sense. But there was also a question about where you are in healthcare. And, you know, Pete Stark was a pretty tireless reformer when it came to healthcare.
Sure. And I'm a supporter of the Affordable Care Act. We're already seeing the benefits of it. In California, hundreds of thousands of new patients will have healthcare because of the Affordable Care Act. I want to make sure that we keep it accessible and affordable, which is key to its implementation. And, you know, we're seeing preventive services already being offered for seniors who are in Medicare, mammograms for women, and prostate cancer exams for men. Free preventive services will bring down the overall cost of Medicare.
But again, Medicare for all. Tremendous opposition in Congress to Obamacare. I mean, and it's been characteristic of this Republican legislature.
37 times the Republicans have tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And although I think that is excessive, I, you know, did enjoy voting against the repeal. The one repeal effort that I was able to vote against a couple weeks ago in the Congress and show that I do stand with you know, the Supreme Court decision that says it's legal, with the president signing it into law and the Congress that voted and passed it. So I think, you know, the verdict is in, to use kind of the parlance of my courtroom days. And it's time to move on and make sure that we can deliver this health care to all.
Well, it's time to move on to some callers, and let's deliver them to you. We begin with Chanel, is it?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. Question is, for discussions such as metadata that should be public discussion, how would this have come to the forefront in the first place if it was not for someone like a whistleblower or a leak? I mean, it's not as if the CIA was forthcoming on this issue. So my question is, how should someone bring this to the public awareness?
Chanel, that's the great question of the day, because as was pointed out in a couple stories I saw today in the Washington Post and the New York Times, is how do we even know that our privacy rights are being violated if this is within a secret court? And so I think what we need to look at now, again, as I said earlier, we need to go back, look at the Patriot Act, look at whether or not it is keeping up to date with, you know, these new technologies that we have in, you know, in our cell phones, our smartphones, social media sites that we all participate in. And then we need to look at, you know, how transparent this court should be, and whether maybe perhaps we could declassify more information for review, you know, by the Congress or, you know, by the American people.
Where do you stand on renewal of Patriot Act 2015?
You know, so you're right. It comes up in 2015. You know, I certainly have concerns, especially when it comes to, you know, libraries. That's included in the Patriot Act. Mm-hmm. I like having free, open, accessible libraries. And I, you know, I expressed concern when I was a non-member of Congress, as just a public citizen, as a private citizen, when that portion was included. But I do look forward to having, you know, this conversation about privacy. I will say, and it can't be forgotten, that if we take the NSA at their word and President Obama at his word, that this program, which ostensibly is targeting foreign nationals and hopefully not targeting Americans, has prevented terrorist attacks. And that's important to remember, because The same critics of the president after the Boston Marathon bombings who are saying, why didn't the FBI know more or do more when they were learning information from Russia? Well, presumably much of the information that the FBI could have used to learn more about the Boston Marathon suspects would have probably required using PRISM or phone records that were being used in the Verizon incident. So, you know, it's a delicate balance between national security and our privacy. And, you know, I would like to make sure that we're not targeting Americans without going through the proper Fourth Amendment protocol. And if we are targeting foreign nationals, that we're absolutely minimizing what information is being collected that involves law-abiding Americans.
What about law-abiding Pakistanis? Do you have a position on the president's use of drones? I mean, he said he'll be more transparent. He said he would cut back. Prime Minister of Pakistan, you know, made a very strong statement this weekend, the new prime minister.
The new prime minister, right.
And so, and yet, you know, the use of drones may be taking out enemies who are planning to do things to our citizens.
Right. The drone strikes, which started under President Bush and were continued under President Obama, have proved to be effective in killing terrorists. However,
and
we have seen
citizens.
Civilians, right?
Yeah, right.
However, we have seen that, you know, innocent people have been, you know, killed as a result of, you know, unintentionally killed as a result of drone strikes. And so, you know, I have the same concerns, which is, you know, the president's use of force with these drone strikes and what type of review exists. And I also, you know, I take the president at his word when he says that he will not use drone strikes to target American citizens on American soil. I mean, I think that is just, that would be flat out unacceptable and beyond the scope of his authority.
This is also a president who many felt was a defender of the Constitution, a constitutional lawyer, Harvard, again, your parents would be very impressed, professor of constitutional law, and yet things like the PRISM program and the Verizon and so forth, I mean, in the interest of security on the one hand, but on the other hand, many people feel terribly violated by this kind of thing. I mean, regardless of whether it's directed at foreign nationals, they still feel that it's an incursion upon their privacy, and it is.
Right, and that's why I say digital awakening. We need to make sure our laws keep up with, you know, the new ways that we receive and access information. And so I err on the side of privacy. And so, you know, we need to minimize the role that the government – we need to minimize the information that law-abiding individuals – that the government is able to access. And so I will always bend toward protecting privacy and individuals over national security. But understanding that, you know, foreign nationals are out there who, you know, wish to do harm to innocent Americans. And finding that balance is a conversation we should have, you know, more than every time the Patriot Act comes
only
up for reauthorization.
Nationals. Remember that one of these the younger of the two Chechens was an American citizen.
That's right.
And, you know, we had an American citizen in Yemen who was hit by a drone. We were talking about possibly people who are nevertheless not foreign in the sense of having become American citizens, technically. We're talking again with Congressman Eric Swalwell, and we've got a couple of callers here who want to talk about the immigration issue specifically, and I want to just hear from one and then the other because they're on different sides here. Jasmine, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about just how the legal immigration is really heavily impacting, you know, recent college graduates. It impacts what we tend to forget about is, you know, the low-skilled jobs that once blacks used to work, and young high school graduates in the food service industry, janitorial, and those people are being displaced as well. And it's hard with a language barrier, you know, when we're being required to speak, you know, Spanish or basic, you know, administrative level jobs. And we do have the workforce of, you know, college graduates. I have friends who are engineers who can't find work in Southern California because of this issue. So I think that that needs to be addressed, and no one talks about those issues. You know, we have a workforce here that we can use for to fill these jobs, and high-skilled jobs and the low-skilled jobs without using illegal immigrant labor.
Right. Jasmine, I thank you for that call. I wanted to have you on record, and I'm appreciative of the call and you're going on record because I want to hear from Pat, who sees things somewhat and frames them differently. Pat, hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys. I work in a Silicon Valley company, big, well-known. We can't get enough qualified resumes in the door. And I don't know, is it because they're screened out beforehand? But we've done just open collection where we just go out looking. We have get-togethers at night, and students and prior employees of other companies, and they have to come and with their resumes. And in the end, when I'm in meetings at the moment, you know, there are eight gentlemen and ladies from the subcontinent with me, myself, and I'm Irish-born. There are no natively born engineers in most of our teams at the moment. Okay. And I just don't understand that. And I would just, since I've got four kids grown here in America, I would just like to, if there's any consideration about making education more affordable for people now, because I think that's part of the issue.
Well said, Pat. Thank you. But here's the Gordian knot, Congressman. I mean, you know, in those two calls, one caller saying we don't, but both of them are saying we can't hire enough native people. We don't have enough native people qualified to hire.
You know, I think there's certainly anecdotal evidence about, you know, a skilled worker who's having a tough time finding a job. But the data is there. And, you know, whether it's a tech company or whether it's a farm, you know, they are having a tough time finding Americans to fill a number of these jobs. And so I think, as I said earlier, that presents a short-term problem, which is, you know, how do we fill thousands of jobs in America? And, you know, a tech company that says and has to prove to get an H-1B visa, remember, they have to, you know, prove under penalty of perjury that they cannot fill the job before they can seek an H-1B visa. That company has two choices. They can seek the H-1B visa or they can send the job overseas. I think it's a better deal for America and it's a better deal for our local economies if the job occurs here. Now, in the long term, I agree with what Pat said, which is we need to better educate our own. We need to have access to education for our own so that they can compete for jobs here in America. We're also, you know, we're a nation of immigrants. We're a nation that was built by immigrants, and I just do not want to just shut the door and say we can do it all here ourselves when we know that right now we're looking at how our children are performing compared to the rest of the world, and we're seeing that in science and math, we're right square in the middle, and 95% of the world marketplace is outside of the United States. So is Brazil, Russia, India, and China, as their middle class is double, and they look for goods and services, they have a number of other places they can look other than America. So we need to make sure that America stays competitive, and I think that means recruiting and attracting top immigrant talent, but also making sure that native-born children are prepared by making investments in science, technology, engineering, and math. As far as access to education, 2 weeks ago in the Congress, the House Republican leadership voted to double the student loan rate, or at least have it go as high as 8 to 10%. Right now it's at 3.4%. I voted against that, and I have supported efforts to freeze the student loan rate at 3.4%. Right now, education continues to rise faster than almost every other good or service or commodity, and it is becoming inaccessible for students in the middle class or for the poor. And so I think, you know, we need to freeze student loan rates at 3.4%, allow people to take loans at that rate, but also, you know, I'm interested in looking at what we can do to make college more affordable and tying student loans to and allowing colleges that keep the cost of tuition down to be able to participate in student loan programs and not allow the colleges that continue to raise rates, you know, 10, 15, 20% every year, you know, not allow them to have access to student loans. So that's an area that I'm interested in exploring further.
Well, we're getting a lot of responses, particularly on the question of immigration and HB1 visas. Ryan writes, how does Congressman reconcile prosecuting someone that has leaked national security information because the individual broke the law, but granting amnesty to those that arrived in this country illegally and by definition also broke the law? This seems to me inconsistent. And David says, how does the congressman feel about the kids of illegal immigrants getting services at the county and state level? some of the kids are illegal as well. How much money does this state spend on these children every year? It must be tens of millions. And I say legalize their parents so they can contribute as well. So, I don't know if you'd agree with that. But
well, Michael, you know, undocumented individuals do pay taxes. There's this misconception that they do not pay taxes. However, they pay sales tax. Many of them who work under a false name or a false Social Security number, just so that they can work, they pay into Social Security. And they're not – so they're actually paying into Social Security, but they're not able to reap the benefits when they're of retirement age because they don't have a real Social Security account. There's actually – it's called the suspended account at the Social Security Administration. Billions of dollars that go into the suspended account, which is money that the Social Security Administration cannot connect to an actual individual because it was likely a false name that was used by an employee seeking to work and gave a false social security number. So they do pay their taxes. They do contribute to our economy. I think immigration reform will allow them to be identified and a part of not just our economy but our community.
Another listener says, the tech industry – this is from your district, Becky in Livermore writes – the tech industry wants more H-1B visas, not because it can't find tech workers in the United States, but because they want to drain India of its tech workers so that a new Silicon Valley isn't established over there to compete with them. I wish they'd just be honest about it. First time I've heard that theory. Have you?
I've heard, you know, arguments that we're draining talent from other countries. And the truth is right now it's a worldwide competitive marketplace where other countries – India, China, Brazil, they're recruiting our talent here. And so if we are not able to compete, if we say close the borders, lock them down, we're not going to bring anyone in, what's going to happen is the United States will become irrelevant when it comes to who provides goods and services. And we can't let that happen. And, you know, Michael, I'll say when I talk about using the innovation agenda to grow the middle class, I say that because if you're in the middle class today, you're making $5,000 less a year than you were 10 years ago. And you also have $25,000 more on average debt than you did 10 years ago. So if we do not grow our middle class, and I think innovation is the way that you do that, our country will face greater and greater problems when it comes to unemployment, when it comes to personal debt, and also when it comes to how we pay for Social Security and Medicare.
Speaking about growing the middle class, I think this next caller wants to ask about public employees, but you're behind this Main Street Revival Act, which would essentially defer payroll taxes on businesses in depressed areas, economically depressed areas. In fact, I believe you co-sponsored this with a Republican, Chris Collins. Yeah.
When I first ran for Congress, I spent 8 weekends knocking on every small business on the main streets in my district, and I asked the business owners, what can the federal government do to help? And they were understandably very pessimistic. But they pointed to the different vacancies across the street or next door. And they told me, if you can get a business to go in across the street or next door, that will increase the foot traffic in our area for our own business. And it will also increase the business-to-business transactions for all of the businesses around here. And so that got me thinking, well, getting capital into the market and getting businesses capitalized is very hard for the federal government to do, aside from the Small Business Administration. But what the federal government does do is it collects the employer side contribution of Social Security and Medicare taxes. So if we could defer those taxes for 1 year and make sure that they're paid back over years 2, 3, and 4, that would give a small business, 25 employers or fewer, more startup capital to hire more workers, increase the foot traffic around them, and also increase business-to-business transactions, get their business model off the ground, and then pay back the taxes in years 2, 3, and 4. It was inspired by policies that we put in place when I was a city councilman in Dublin, and other cities around us were
– you got a bill now, House Bill 952.
And I also know that in this era of partisan politics, that the only way to really get something done is to do it in a bipartisan fashion in the Congress. And so I sought a Republican co-sponsor, Chris Collins from New York, who is a small businessman himself. And we have a number of Republicans on the bill now and a number of Democrats. And, you know, I hope that it remains bipartisan and we can move it forward and get a vote for it on the House floor.
And we'll take another call. And that's you, Adam. Good morning.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the congressman to elaborate on his comment around the uni official that was paid $300,000 or $400,000.
BART official, Adam. That was a BART official.
BART official, sorry. Yeah, sorry. Clearly, that was a poor contract. But it seems to me that publicly elected officials often resist and publicly discourage competitive salaries for non-elected public servants. And it would seem to me that to have a vibrant community of public servants, we need to have a pretty competitive salary for those folks. And so how could we put success metrics in place that they're able to meet so that they're paid on performance rather than just a flat rate?
No, Adam, that's a great question. And having private sector metrics tied to public agency salaries isn't a bad idea. But, you know, public service to me is public service. It means that you're not being paid the same as you would be in the private sector. And you're taking, you know, you're going to have working conditions that are, you know, that can support you and your family, that you'll have a retirement that is decent. But you're doing a public service, a public good. You're making a personal sacrifice to help your community. And, you know, I think we need to always remember that when we set any agency director or public elected official salary.
Let me thank the caller. A couple other emails on the H-1B visa. Listener writes, one issue in the immigration reform debate that never seems to come up is that the H-1B visa increase is being made to help the very same companies that haven't been paying the taxes to support the educational system that they say has not provided the resources that they need right now. The increase in H-1B visas is nothing more than a bailout of tech companies that haven't paid their fair share. You can understand that sentiment, I think, particularly when, as I alluded to before, we know that these companies are not – I mean, remember talking about you know, some of the junior colleges where Apple's in Cupertino and how they could have benefited if Apple had been paying those taxes instead of having little companies with two or three people abroad and being able to avoid the taxes. And the listener writes on our website, on the other hand, I work in the immigration field, and I, along with most, if not all, of my colleagues, find the H-1B cap ridiculous. The U.S. is training a bunch of these immigrants here in the U.S. when they come on an F-1 student visa. And because the cap is met each year, their status transfer from student visa to work visa is denied. Instead, after years of education in the U.S., they are forced to bring the knowledge and talent acquired in the U.S. back to China and India.
That's
both
what,
good points, I think.
Both very good points. And that's my fear, is that we will educate and train them here in the United States, and then they will compete against us overseas. So I would rather have a path for them to stay here. They call it the green card staple visa, meaning that if you get a graduate degree here in the United States, the green card is essentially stapled to your degree so that you can participate in our economy, especially in the areas of science, technology, engineering, and math.
Another caller who wrote to us before, Joe, said he didn't answer my question. Does he support Medicare for all?
Yes.
Okay. That question answered, Joe. And here's Karen. Karen, good morning.
Good morning. I'm not a constituent, but I've become a fan.
Just from this program.
Thank you, Karen.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The reason I'm calling is there was an article in the Chronicle maybe a couple of weekends ago about the immigration bill. And as I read it, certain employers who hire some of the people for technical positions are going to be allowed to be exempted from payroll taxes. I'm very concerned about this as a precedent. It sounds like a foot in the door to weaken Social Security, and a really bad choice of incentives, and I hope that this does not become a part of the permanent bill. I want to know what you know about this and your thoughts.
Thank you, Karen. I read that same Chronicle story, and it pointed out, and it had a Newark business owner talking about how this allows an employer to get around paying the employer side of the contribution. And as I understand it, these employees would, just as the employer would not have to pay in to Social Security and the employee would not be paying into Social Security, at the same time, the employee would not be able to collect Social Security because they would not be considered a citizen and have access to Social Security. Now, that being said, I still think Social Security, whether somebody collects it or not, you know, is a social benefit for our country, where if we did not have Social Security, over 60% of our seniors would be in poverty. So I share Karen's concerns that you could have a whole workforce of people here not paying into Social Security, but being a part of our community, and then having businesses not having to pay those taxes, which allow them, I think, to be more competitive when they're having more capital, but not contributing to our community by paying those Social Security taxes. It's a valid point, and it will certainly be a part of the comprehensive immigration bill.
And thank you, Karen, for the call. Only a couple minutes left, but do you have a position on Syria about either helping the resistance in Syria or taking in refugees? Because now there's talk about, you know, the decision forthcoming possibly to take in this extraordinary number of refugees who are just pouring out of that country here in the United States.
That's right. And my concern right now as far as escalating our presence there to a kinetic level, meaning providing arms or actually sending in our own troops, is that we have learned a lot of hard lessons about going into that region of the world without many allies and, you know, with so many different forces on the ground. I mean, you have a Sunni and Shiite dispute taking place there, and you also risk—
Dispute is a kind word.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the region, but— my fear would be arms getting into the hands of radical Islamic groups coming from the United States. So I support, you know, continuing to, you know, promote and support democracy in the region with economic aid and also what Secretary of State John Kerry has done as far as trying to—
He's giving material aid to the rebels who may indeed be turning toward al-Qaeda.
but not arms aid.
At this point, no.
And I, at this point, I don't support arms aid.
Thank you for being with us. Good luck. And I hope your prospects continue to be bright in terms of this Congress. It is, heaven knows, tough up there on the Hill. So thank you.
Thanks, Michael. And can I just say, we are on social media. I write all of my own tweets, all of my own Facebook posts, and that's at Rep. Swalwell on Twitter.
You got your plug-in. Thank you for being with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.